Hello, everybody. It's time for another Shop Talk Show. Episode number 220, where Dave and I are going to be doing a rapid-fire episode. Lots of questions and answers, as many as we can get through. We're going to be talking about things like web design and development, quote-unquote certifications, single-page apps. We're going to talk about attempting to build a service where people can download files that are kind of protected behind a login system. We're going to try and figure out what the difference between a static site generator and a flat file CMS is, if we possibly can. Recommendations for online forms, lots of stuff. Stay tuned for the episode. I should mention that this show is brought to you by Rollbar.com. Go to Rollbar.com/shoptalkshow and get their bootstrap plan for free for 90 days, which is awesome. Put errors in their place. It is an error tracking app, a very nice one for your app. We'll tell you more about that later in the show, but for now, Dave, please kick things off.
Hey there, Shopomaniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a rock opera about front-end web design and development.
Good.
I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer.
There were so many notes in that intro song.
Somebody should map it out and go crazy. Speaking of procedurally generated music, have you seen Jake Alba's code pen?
Oh, yeah, I have. Yeah. In fact, he literally calls one of his pens procedurally generated music.
It's so beautiful. It's just like you type in a word and like code generates a score and its notes are being written out in front of your face.
Oh, right. That one was awesome where you could type in a word and it like would generate a song, a unique song based on that word. Yeah, he's done so many weird music. There's one where he like has infinite scrolling songs that are like notes that are like chosen to be together based on a key kind of thing. That one was pretty wild. And then there's like, you know, there's like beat machines that go with chords and stuff. He's done a lot of like web audio API stuff that's pretty rad. Jake goes on little rants.
Yeah, nice. Code. It's a very welcome, very experimental. I like it. That's why we mentioned it here on the procedurally generated talk show. I'm Dave Rupert. Chris, what are we doing here today?
Well, God, what is this? Episode 220. It's been a while. It almost is procedurally generated at this point. It is a rapid fire show. We're going to do as many questions as we possibly can. I have one here from Bob Waterview. Hi, guys. I work with people who believe in certifications as the most important thing, more so than just building websites. I suspect those avenues are wastes of time, and I'm curious as to what percentage of successful designer developers actually take certifications or if they're simply self-taught for the most part. Some simply suggest, you know, just taking lynda.com courses or Mark Lassoff's certified web developer course. And then there's Adobe certifications and Microsoft certifications and some kind of HTML5 one or something. He lists a bunch of them here. Zend, certified engineer of PHP accreditations. Since you seem to be, you know, yada yada, what are your thoughts on the recommendations for certification? So we've talked about this a little bit before. Bob works with some people who think that these certifications are everything.
So this is tough. So I think our standard advice is LOL certifications, right? That's like our standard opinion.
Have you ever met somebody who took these things seriously? I mean,
maybe yes, but like I saw this question come in, I guess, through the email a long time ago or a while ago, not so long ago, but I put myself in Bob's shoes and if it's important in your workplace or the people you work with, or maybe even the town you work in, cause it could be like a scene kind of thing. Maybe you got to play the game. You know what I'm saying? Like if certifications are important, you got to play the certification game to be employable. Am I crazy talking?
No, of course not. There are some circles in which some things like this matter. Maybe not so much when you're I don't know, getting a job as a startup or doing your own freelancing thing or whatever. But, you know, some things matter, some things don't. I think there's a lot of, like, game playing garbage with these things, though. Like, if you, you know, if me and Dave could throw up a course and be like, get the CSS3 certification, Dave and I will personally sign your certificate and you'll be
so good at it.
Yeah, you know, show any employer and you'll instantly get a job. And we charge $500 for it. We'd be snake oil salesmen.
We should charge a lot of money for it, but we should not eliminate the Shop Talk Academy. As if you'd like to apply to Shop Talk Academy, send your money to Dave Rupert PayPal.
It's a gray area, especially because you probably actually do learn something from most of these things that you go through and stuff. It's just, I would find it off-putting. If you want the real truth of it, I've hired people. I'm going to be probably hiring more people at some point in my life. If somebody came and sent me a list of all the certifications they got online, it's not going to do you any favors. It isn't. Like,
right, because now it's almost a responsibility because you have to verify it, right? Like, I could put Dave Rupert School of Education and you'd have to be like, is that a real thing? Is that an accredited thing? Is that something anyone cares about?
I've never heard of Mark Lassoff Certified Web Developer course. Apologies to Mark Lassoff or anybody who has and finds it very valuable. But just because your friend coworkers have that thing, I wouldn't know what that was. And in fact, just being a human being, I might roll my eyes at it a little bit at first just because I'd just be like, I don't know. Like, I don't know. I'm like pretty involved in this industry. And like, I'm hiring somebody who's, you know, probably is too, because this is the job. So like, if you're throwing weird ass certifications at me, but you know, I think we talked about this once before, in which I said that like, if I was going to like hire someone to like set up really specific like AWS services for us, or like I was going to hire somebody to implement like a analytics package for us that was really specific, I might actually reach out for somebody who like specializes in and is possibly certified in that technology because it is so specific.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. There's like two things I can think of that, like two businesses I really like that recently started offering certifications. Treehouse now does certifications, which they already did badges, and I'm really not sure how different it is. But I know, but I trust that they're trying to do a good thing just because I think the company is good. But then there's like Unity is offering certified Unity developers. And for that, I could see that very helpful, because if you're a game development shop and you have to ship a game in 1 or 2 years, you need somebody who knows it, not just somebody who, like, you need junior devs who know it. You can't just like be like, oh, you've played with Unity, cool, like I'm gonna build my business on, you know, on somebody who kind of knows it. You know, you need somebody like you need somebody with bona fide skills, you know, and vetting those skills might take too much time. I don't know. So you're sort of outsourcing your vetting, right? I don't know either.
We've talked about it enough, probably. William Mallow?
Yeah. Writes in, what service would you recommend for allowing people to pay and download a file? Ooh, this is a good one. So you want to accept money for a digital download?
Yeah, digital download. You know, I don't know. What would you do, Dave?
I've used these in the past, but I can't think of which ones I've used.
Well, what would be your process? How would you start thinking about what you're going to do?
Okay, so I have a file. I want money, right? I would probably set up Stripe thing. And then once that goes through, I would auto send some email with it to a poorly secured.
You're already thinking of implementing it. You'd hand roll it.
I would probably hand roll it. I know I was going to say Drew Wilson, who's been on the show. He has a thing, kind of a platform called Plasso. I've heard him talk about, and it's kind of for kind of digital download things. So, and that's built off of, he did this with, what was his icon set?
Super popular now. I can't remember.
Pictos. Only because you can't. Pictos. Yeah. Yeah, Pictos. So he like sold billions of dollars worth of Pictos. And so he kind of has like know-how into how that works. So I would kind of trust him. He has good user experience too.
So that's another way of thinking about it is hand roll it or look around for pre-existing solutions from people that have already done it, you know? Like if you're asking me what I recommend, William, I'd probably error on using a service before I hand roll it just because my experience is so limited with it. And it seems like the incentives are lined up for something like Plaso to do a good job with it. So like, don't you want to just do a good job out of the gate, you know? Or, you know, so I don't know. That's generally how I think these days. It's like, you know, there's no way that this thing is so expensive that it's going to like ruin me if I choose to pay for some service for this. And I know that they're like going to have customer support and do a good job selling this thing. And the only reason I'd bring it in-house is if I was, you know, betting the farm on this thing. This is my business. This is how I intend to do my thing for sure. I have hand-rolled this in the past, or I comboed it with WordPress. So I ended up using some WordPress plugin, Restrict Content Pro, to like restrict access to like even looking at a URL. And the URL was like, okay, now you can download it from here. And then I hand-rolled the part where you download it, because Amazon S3 can do this thing where you can only download the file if it has like a uniquely generated key. And there was a PHP way to generate those keys. So like on the WordPress templates that generated those pages, it would generate a time-limited version of one of those keys.
Oh my God, my blood pressure is going up.
It really wasn't that hard. It was just generated. PHP was just like, oh, here's a new random key. And I made the anchor link for the downloading the file, use that key. And then if it went 60 seconds before it started, that key wasn't valid anymore. And that's it. And so I wrote like a JavaScript or thing that was like a set timeout that if 60 seconds went by and they hadn't clicked that link, it just said, this is expired. If you want another one, you're going to have to refresh the page.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. I mean, so I was going to throw out another option. Shopify, pretty good service. They do a lot of e-commerce and they'll actually handle the account system too, because that's the other, you need an account system.
Yeah. That's why I used WordPress, because like, you know, you want to be, but then you need like a login system to be like, well, I paid for this file. I want to be able to log in at any time and get it. Hand rolling your own login system. Now that's not going to, you know, that's fine. It's just, but then you're building this whole thing again. So it's kind of like, yeah, Shopify makes sense, right? It depends on the thing. Are you just trying to like, I don't know, make a cool icon set and sell it? I would use an existing service. Are you starting the next chapter of your life as a developer? Then maybe look into hand rolling.
Yeah. All right. Well, good luck. Let us know what you end up with. Vince Brown writes, and my question for you is EMS versus REMS. Which one should I be using? I'm a newbie to web design and development, just starting up this past year, and have recently started working on responsive sites. The first couple I've built have been using REMS, partly because I'm a little afraid of the cascading effect of EMS, and REM provides a little more comfort in my learning stage. Not having to worry about cascade and possibly messing it up with my media queries. Everything I seem to read is 50-50. Is there a best practice? Does the M and its ability to cascade provide more power in its use, or does it really even matter? Good question.
I don't know. What do you do? I think M's are a pain in the butt for that very reason. For that thing that you're like, oh, LIs are 1.1 M's big. And then all of a sudden you have a nested list and you have these cascading, awkwardly getting bigger things. So I found it much easier to just say, I just use REMS everywhere. And just using REMS everywhere just is nice, because then I can adjust things at a document level and everything kind of scales together. And it doesn't always work. And in fact, you know, any kind of prescriptive, this is how you should set the size of type thing, there's always going to be little gotchas, I think. But I did write a post at one time that suggested pixels at the root, which could be percentages or anything too, but some kind of like stronger thing at the that you set at like the HTML element, and then you use REM for like blocks of stuff, like an article or a module or a footer or a comment or something like that, and then use M within those, because I think that can be kind of useful, because sometimes if you go all REM all the time and then you like notch it down, you know, it's like you're rocking like 20 pixels for desktop or something, and then you're like, eh, I'm going to squeeze the window a little bit. I want to get the font size a little bit smaller. I'm going to go like 18 and then squeeze a little bit. I'm going to make the root like 16. Everything's scaling down. And then at some point, like, text got way too small up in your footer or something like that. So you're like, dang it. Now I got to like redo that. It's easier to be like, well, that component just got too small. So I'm just going to bump up that component's rem a little bit. And then the whole component comes up with it. You don't have to like micro target things. I know that's hard to explain, but I think controlling text at a component level is kind of nice.
Yeah. I use M's. I think I like the cascade. I'm very used to it. It's just you set M's and then you kind of adjust the body type. That's usually it. Or, you know, I like the proportionality too. I like that, you know, if I don't know, my paragraph text is 1 or 16 pixels, then my headings are M's, set in M's. They're relative to the body text or whatever. I like that. Rems would lock it down. They would kind of control things, but that's fine. I'm trying to think. So I think I probably use M's though, because I lived through a time where browsers didn't have rems, you know, like,
yeah, maybe.
But now they all do. Or at least all the ones you probably care about do. So you could probably switch to rems entirely. This is kind of a new puzzle to me. I haven't really thought of it. So I think you could totally just rock rems.
You'll just get better at it and just test, you know, make sure that you are testing what you're doing and you'll probably be fine. This is an eternal debate, you know. It's interesting that you're struggling with it now. Vince, I'm sure if you wrote back in 4 years, you'd be like, you know what's kind of hard? Sizing type throughout an entire app or website or whatever.
Yeah. I'd be curious if somebody went all in on rems like 2 years ago, where do they stand now, you know, or how do they feel about it? So anyway, next question.
Ryan H., what's the current best practice and thinking behind inlining CSS and JavaScript for SPAs, single page apps? The goal would be to minimize HTTP requests and have the page ultimately load faster. During development, JavaScript and CSS is maintained separately and then would be inlined into the HTML page with a Webpack or Gulp build. Less network requests is obviously better, but how does this affect caching? Is there anything else to watch out for? So when I'm reading this, I'm like, are you talking about... Okay, so we're talking about single-page apps. So the idea is, you know, the classic kind of thing where you load one page of the site and then a front end like empire starts. So any link that you click on, it might change the URL, but really it's just front end Ajax calls and stuff doing magical stuff behind the scenes and shifting things around on the page. So like there is no fresh page load ever again. That type of definition of SPA, or I guess the only definition of SPA. So Ryan's saying, what if you like made that first request not even have a link element in it, not even have a script element in it? It would have a script element, but you would just make the HTML document have all of the CSS and JavaScript all in it on the very first page load. Is that what he's
saying? Well, okay, yeah. I mean, I think this argument, or this, I guess, like argument is very thin that like, oh, if I eliminate the blocking link tag, I will successfully make everything faster because everything will be inside JavaScript. The problem here is JavaScript requires memory and execution. And like, if you try to do the more JavaScript you put into a phone, the worse it does. So I think you're probably going to negate any kind of performance gain versus a style sheet. Let's see. Would it be cached? I suppose it would be cached. I don't know. If you're doing a lot of component-based, you know, React-style component-based CSS, it might make sense to just go ahead and do all the CSS in the JavaScript, sort of like the opposite of what I was saying. But maybe you ship what they're, you know, Adi Asmani and Google are calling the app shell, like just the header, Chrome, body, text, you know, some media queries. Maybe you ship that in an inline style block and that would not be cached. But if you're like, a truly single page app, that should be pretty covered, right? That should, you should never have to change that style block again, right? So,
yeah.
And then everything else would be inline, so your cascade would be stronger. So,
I don't know that I even care that much. It's like, dude, what is this going to save that much? Is it going to make that big of a difference to your app? Why don't you just do link rel equals style sheet, href global CSS? It downloads this freaking CSS for your website. And like we've done since the beginning of time. Like you could still do a critical rendering thing, and like you were talking about.
Or, yeah, that's what I was describing poorly. But I think you like that's your only solution to make a JavaScript app feel fast. I mean, because JavaScript has to download, it has to execute, and then it has to fetch whatever it needs to fetch, and then it comes back, and then it has to execute what it just fetched, and then it has to render and paint that. And then, like, so you're already like 7 steps away from just rendering from a statically served document. So, you know, to talk about fast is sort of in the Google terms of fast, like that's, it's somewhat moot. Does that make sense? I mean, like,
yeah,
you're, like fast in JavaScript is maybe not, it shouldn't be in the same sentence, especially on a phone. Yikes. What did I say? Dave, you're going to get tweets. Okay. Next question. Did you have anything else?
No.
Okay, Oliver Williams writes in, I am a big fan of static site generators. I've been hearing a lot about them. I've heard less, however, about flat file CMSs. I am curious about them. Have you tried any of them? What do you think?
I don't even know there is a big difference between those two things. Is it pedantic?
Yeah, I don't. I mean, what would a flat file be? Like one giant, like
I think document? It's kind of like, isn't what, you know, what do the old timers always say about like, this is how text pattern used to work. It generates, I think it's just like, it generates HTML files and that's what gets used, but that's what a static file generator is. So, or that's what a static site generator. So I actually don't even know. I can't even nitpick the difference between a flat file CMS and a static site generator. It seems like the same thing to me.
Yeah, I don't really know. Let's see. I just Googled flat file CMS. I'm on a cool website for Grav, getgrav.org.
I saw that one. I see Pico. I see Fansoro. I see Monstra. There's a whole bunch of them. We've had the Kirby guy on the show before. Kirby?
So does that count as a
file? Well, it doesn't say flat, but it says it's a file-based CMS. And remember how that worked and that it was like, it uses some flat files for stuff, but it like also uses PHP and stuff where needed. It was like a combination. It does, like, whereas a static site generator means on the deployed site, there is no server-side processing whatsoever. Like when you deploy a Jekyll site, there's nothing that can do any server code stuff at all. No Python, no PHP, no Ruby, no nothing. Whereas Kirby like was flat files for a lot of stuff, but it also did a little light PHP action where it needed to be. I think that's how Perch works too. It has some PHP where needed.
Yeah.
I think they're contested in MySQL though too, to be fair.
So is this just some custom generator is running? That's sort of our...
Or that you can blog as a markdown file, but like some of the other actual functionality of the site is still uses server-side processing. So the flat files are the content. I don't know. I guess it feels weird to sit here speculating about it.
Oh, Grav uses Composer, which is PHP, right? So it's just some PHP sort of thing. Okay. Well, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful website. So I think these are just... static site. I'm going to call them static site generators under another name. Please leave a comment if we mess that up.
I guess that's all we can say, you know. And people are so firm about the anytime I've ever written anything about CMSs, people are like, but what about Ghost? And what about, you know, like everybody's got their favorite things like, oh, you haven't given Statomatic a fair shake in this blog post or whatever. That's because there's 2 million of these. And there's new ones all the time. And I don't think that that's necessarily a problem, but I don't think that because I just didn't mention your favorite one in this blog post. That, anyway, that's a rant.
Yeah. Well, and it's okay. So, all right. here's the, can, I think I've discovered the nuance. Is this okay?
Yeah.
Is this
okay? If you got the nuance, let's hear it.
I think it's similar to a static site generator, but it's something that it runs PHP, this graph, it'll create a server or an Apache or whatever. And it runs, there's a user admin, there's like an administrative interface, somewhat like WordPress, but it must, I think here's the twist, is it spits out HTML and not dynamic like pages, like
so where do you view this admin? Do you view it on your website or do you view it locally only?
I think on the website. And so
right, so it, so which you, there it, isn't one for like Jekyll, Octopress, whatever, like that's,
yeah,
that's the difference, is that.
And so I mean this is I had this in 2004. It was movable type, I believe. So I'm, oh, I hope I'm wrong, or I hope, I don't know, everything just came full circle or something. So, yeah, I don't know.
Maybe it, that's it. Though. I bet it, that is nice. It. There's like an admin area that really does use all these server-side technologies, and it's hosted up on your server. But when people come and hit daveruper.com/cool blog post, they're just getting an HTML file, a flat file.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see.
Oh, okay. Sorry if we messed that up, everybody. Thank you.
Okay. This episode Next of question. Shop Talk Show Go is brought ahead. To you in part by Rollbar. That's rollbar.com/shoptalkshow. It's an awesome app. Let me tell you, your app is throwing errors. It just is. All of ours are. Do you know about them? I hope you do, because most of the users that are experiencing those errors are frustrated, and it's very good to know about those errors. Rollbar is this thing that you can integrate into your site within a few minutes, really, and it tells you about those errors. So there's like a proper place, a proper dashboard for tracking those errors and how critical of an error it was and how much it's happening and how important it is. Help you diagnose the errors and then defeat those errors. Vitally important stuff for any website, and it's kind of an awesome way to do that. So it works with all the major languages and frameworks. Like I said, very easy to install. You can integrate it into your other workflows, like, oh, there's a big major error, we should probably send that over to HipChat or Slack or whatever, or GitHub, whatever it needs to be. Lots of people are using Rollbar, Heroku, Twilio, Kayak, Instacart, Zendesk, Twitch, lots of big places using Rollbar to track their errors, something that you really have no choice. And you need to be knowing about the errors that are happening on your website and make it your priority to deal with these errors so that you're not just losing customers and, you know, essentially having a buggy, awful web app. You know, the way that you fix and make robust web apps is tracking and knowing about errors and then dealing with them, and Rollbar helps you do that. They are also hooking up Shop Talk Show fans. You get their Bootstrap plan for free for 90 days. 3 months free you can be using Rollbar, which is very generous of them. Thanks for the sponsorship.
Kevin C. writes in, what are some services you recommend for online forms? I generally develop sites using WordPress, and I generally use Gravity Forms. Recently, with a number of clients, it's getting hard to maintain updates with some of our clients that are using older versions, causing some sites to have security issues. Is there a better WordPress plugin or maybe a third-party service that is easy to integrate? Have you made a form in the last couple months, Dave?
I've broken some forms, but not a lot. Not too many forms.
I had to make one. You know, I worked at WooFoo back in the day, and that's obviously one that we can mention here that I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with. It's a third-party service. It'll absolutely work with your WordPress sites. Probably easy to manage as users and stuff. So that's a thing. It's not a hell of a lot different than it was a bunch of years ago, but that can be fine. It's like almost feature complete product. Anyway, it used to make Gravity Forms used to make me mad, because I think in the early days of Gravity Forms, I thought that their UI was very ripped off from WooFoo. It had a lot of, even some of the like dialogues that popped up was like, you're like stealing copy and stuff. You know, it just used to annoy me. But Gravity Forms has been chugging along for a long time now. That kind of drag and drop form building UI has become kind of a standard way to approach things. it's kind of, it's like a pretty damn nice interface. It helps a lot of people do what they need to do. It kind of appeals to me that it saves form data in the WordPress database. You know, it's like, it's a part of the empire that is your site, not necessarily a third party. So, you know, I think Gravity Forms is a way to go. You're saying, you know, they have old versions of it and stuff. Can't you just upgrade those versions? Or is that like costing money that they're not willing to spend or what? It seems like not using Gravity Forms because sometimes it goes out of date is kind of a bad reason to not use it.
Yeah. I mean, if you need something simple, WordPress has that feedback feature now, or maybe it's a Jetpack thing.
Well, they have PolDaddy as well, which is a WordPress thing where you can build forms on it. And yeah, Jetpack has that thing.
I mean, Jetpack should be pretty easy to update. Security issues are a huge problem.
I was making one with Google Forms the other day, which has gotten a lot better. It used to be like, I feel like this like weird attachment to spreadsheets, and it just so happened that you could make a form out of a spreadsheet kind of thing. But it's like grown up into its own product, its own proper.
Well, yeah, I should say that we use Google Forms to kind of power all of Daytrip, like all the feedback and the like submitting spots you can
really
do as a and it just dumps into a Excel spreadsheet. It doesn't do a great job of notifying us, I think, but Reagan maybe figured that out.
No, that's what I was making one the other day because I had to for something I wanted to use it for. And first of all, I found the UX of using it was awesome. Like the form building abilities and choices and stuff felt very modern and appropriate and easy to understand and stuff. I think they did an awesome job with the form builder of Google Form. And then it comes down the end, you're like, okay, now send me emails for the ones that are submitted. And they're like, oh no, that's not we don't have that.
Oh, we don't do that.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah. It seems like a pretty, pretty standard thing, right? So
yeah, they're pretty design limited in what you can do and stuff too. But it is, you know, it's a nice form building experience, and they give you a URL and you can embed them, which means you can embed them on your WordPress site. So there's lots of options there. We just recently published a blog post on CSS Tricks of specifically what you're asking, Kevin, of options for building forms these days, which covers some other options as well. So I'll link that up in the show notes.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, Google. I'm interested because I need maybe a contact form on my website about books, because I got all these publishers coming at me after this last episode. Oh, boy. Okay. Nick Novak writes in, when should you delete Git branches? Should you delete them right after the change fix is added, merge with the master? But I find that if you keep them around to fix something from that feature or add something else in said branch, the master is so different from other workflow. So then I just delete that branch and create a new one. So I have to have a clean clone of the master.
So you're working on Daytrip and you're adding like a text my friend feature or something like
text
that.
Text my
and
friend.
You made a, do you do the thing where you make a branch that's dr/something, like you'd namespace it? We do that.
No.
It's kind of cool because then it puts it, like if you use Tower, it puts them in folders and stuff. There's some cool stuff that you get when you do like your initials slash. But anyway, so you make feature slash text my friend, and then it goes to master because you're done working on the feature. Like, and you submit a pull request to master, and somebody looks at it or whatever. When you do a pull request in GitHub, it offers you to delete that branch like that second. So a lot of people do that. I do that a lot. Like, okay, it's merged to master now. I might as well kill this branch so you don't have like thousands of branches sitting around, which is obnoxious. And it really is obnoxious too when you're trying to search for ones and like look through all the stuff that's going on. And Nick's saying, like, well, if you don't, though, like, should you delete it, like, that second, or maybe keep it around, like, a week? Because then, like, at least, like, if you need to fix something, you can hop back over to that branch and fix it quick and then merge it back to master again. But Nick is saying, well, then it's out of date from master. Well, just pull from master again then, you know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think you want to, like, if you think there's going to be like some continuing ongoing work, like for this thing, like change requests or somebody's doesn't like it or something. Maybe the solution is to have like a staging or development or test branch or something that is sort of like a precursor to master. And then development gets merged into master at some point. And then everyone's kind of committing to development and then masters the deployment one, right? I would consider doing something like that if you wanted to. But I think if once it's submitted, like, get rid of it. Cause I've been in the position where it's like people are just messing around and, you know, working here and there. And then those branches don't get deleted. And then like 3-4 months down in the project, you're like, dude, what are all these branches? Like, what, you know, you like open it up or you need to switch branches and you're just like, there's 16 of these. How do I, which one's the right one? And why are they all 60 commits ahead of master? You know, like what is going on? So, I think that's something to be wary of is
yeah. Once you do a pull request on it, just kill it. Cause cutting a new branch to fix a thing that's broken is also trivially easy, you know, just cut and then name it fixing friend.
Right. Cause you're not developing a feature. You're fixing a thing that's already there.
There's no cost to branches. There's none.
Just cut them and kill them. I heard that somebody give a talk about Git and basically a branch is just a bookmark in code. It's almost like it's a bookmark for this date and this state. And so that's all it is. And so like you can create more bookmarks, no problem. It doesn't matter.
GitHub even has a stale branches like part of their UI when you're looking at the branches. So if you are in a troubled spot and you want to like go clean up some stuff, it helps you do that, which is nice. There's just a trash can. You can just be like, gone, 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 gone.
murder. All right. Next question.
Stina Kuarnstrom. I'm in a small team of 4 web developers. Where we develop a web application CRM. Recently, in a code review, there was discussion over some CSS where I thought it was a bad idea to add direct descendant selectors when they are not needed, but the other person thought that even though they have a problem of causing bugs if the markup changed, they're good since they're more optimized, meaning faster, and speed up the rendering of the page. And that it's good to keep in mind. Is there something you bother with? What do you prefer? You're going to style a UL. UL, class equals main nav. And then you're going to style the LIs within it. So UL, LI. Or do you go UL, arrow selector, direct descendant destructor, LI?
I think this is really weird. I mean, I don't know why you'd ever choose the buggy version or the bug causing version, you know, just don't have them unless you need them. Like they're there for when you need them. Otherwise the cascade works just fine. I mean, if somebody adds a div or nests a div and decide another div, now all the CSS is broke. And now you got to fix the CSS when you fix the component. I wouldn't.
That's true. Mm. And those things come up when, I don't know. It's kind of tough. I use them sometimes. I use them when you're like, when I'm writing a selector and I'm just like, can I imagine a situation in which that there is a nested version of this same thing and I don't want this style there? And I'm like, I can imagine that because maybe it's someday this is a drop down menu or this is just, we're not talking about a list. I'm talking about modules that could be nested within each other or something. And I'm like, I'm going to toss an arrow on there because I want it to not have these styles if that nesting happens one day.
Well, and I also use it like the ULLI example, like UL arrow LI, when I only want the direct descendant. I don't like if somebody adds like a bunch of LIs later on in the component, like child, you know, LIs, like I don't want to affect those. I only want to affect these. Like there's a level of explicitity. Oh gosh, didn't get that out there. Explicitity there that is really helpful, but I think you just got to be careful. I find it weird that the other person is like, oh yeah, they cause bugs, but their CSS faster because that's the worst argument ever.
Like you can quote us on this one or whatever. It's been talked about endlessly. That debate is over now as far as I'm concerned. As far as I'm concerned, it never even started. How fast your CSS selectors are, don't
totally
care.
debunked. Don't, it doesn't affect, you know, a micro, like, you're maybe
the only caveat there is if you're working in some crazy browser environment with like a million nodes and all kinds of crazy stuff going on, in which case you know that and then you can start looking into those issues. But for you and I and 99% of things that get worked on, do not worry about your CSS selector performance.
There's not a case study where somebody was like, and then we added the direct descendant selector, Chris, and we fixed all of our performance problems.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I went through my whole code base and added a whole bunch of right arrow thingies, and our site screams now.
Now it's speed index 10. It just zipped up there. Uh-huh. Okay, next question is actually an audio question, which is our favorite kind of question over here at the Shop Talk Show. It comes from Felicia Betancourt. Here we go.
Hey, guys. Love your show, and I really love the new formats that you're experimenting with. I have a really quick question that I think is not too common. I'd like to offer my clients a web audit so that I can offer metrics before and after I do a project for them. What do you think are the most important items to include in a web audit? This would be for clients who aren't techies or web professionals. Thanks.
All right, Chris.
Yeah, a web audit is what Felicia is asking about for clients. I would suspect that it's like, it's not, your onus isn't to provide the perfect web audit. You're in business here and you're working for clients. You should do a web audit that is of the things that you could possibly provide, you know? Like if you go to a place to look at your car, it's not their job to be like, well, you got some paint scratches here, or like the CD in your CD player is scratched, you know, like that's not their, they're not doing an audit on your life and your music options or whatever. They're doing an audit on your car and the things that they can fix on your car. So they're going to look and see if the things that they do need doing.
Yeah.
So when you take it.
Well, I'm thinking for people who aren't web professionals, you want to give something kind of visual. You know, like a link to their webpage test probably isn't great, but if you can kind of like highlight some numbers, you know, you're looking for, you want to target in the next version.
Sure, which you would give them if that's the kind of work that you do.
But yeah, I mean, like you should, like, I mean, page speed insights would be good. Webpage test, any accessibility stuff, like I'm thinking of the Chrome accessibility developers tools, like kind of like errors on the page that you'd like to fix. I probably wouldn't do an HTML validator. That seems out of date or not useful.
You know what? I was looking at a tool the other night. This is just going to be a free plug, I think, because they're definitely not a sponsor of this show. It was called Dare Boost. And it just says, ooh, test, analyze, and optimize your website. So it's a little bit like, web page test or whatever, and it gives you some of those recommendations. It probably uses some of that stuff under the hood, but it like combines a whole bunch of those web audit kind of things together. So like if you're not going to use an HTML validator, which I'd agree, that's kind of like, meh, who cares? Sometimes it's fun to see like, oh, shoot, I used duplicate IDs on the page here, and that undercovered that. I should clean that up because it might cause a problem one day. This stuff will catch that stuff, and it will catch your performance stuff and security stuff and theoretically SEO stuff and stuff like that all in one report. So I thought they did a pretty good job with it.
Oh, that's kind of nice. Like a service that kind of goes off and does all the things you are going to do anyway. That's kind of helpful. I don't know. I think those are sort of things I would test. And I've seen people use like if the client has it, like Clicktail data or like heat maps and stuff, that seems to like, oh, that'll get clients. But that's something you have to install on their server, right? And so, and then you like kind of like read the tea leaves and you interpret that data for them. But I think it, if you can imagine, like if they're not web professionals, maybe they know how people use the site, but maybe they're ignorant to it. So,
I bet you could put together something, be like, oh, here's some forms you have on their site. Look, I had trouble filling them out. That's a problem. Or this, you know, looks like a disabled field when it wasn't and stuff like that. And, oh, here, I squished your website to this particular width, which is representative of these devices. And look, it's kind of busted right here. It's not responsive at all. And I do responsive web design work. So look at that. I looked at some of your images that weren't optimized, you know, or like, you know, this here's I have plenty of ideas that for design improvements we could do on this side. That's what I would put in an audit is things like that, whatever it is that you do.
Enter the boardroom with a cell phone and pull up their website on the phone and just pass the phone around. That's all you'd need to do. Yeah. I think like those pretty standard tests that you would use every day would work. Oh, can I tell you about a new one?
Yep.
There's this thing called Vorlorn.js. It's a Microsoft-y thing, but they have a Chrome extension now. Hello. And you like pull it up if you're on Windows. It's Windows only. Sorry, Mac people. But it's Vorlorn.js, I think, is where you'd find it. But it's basically just like here's some UX-y things. Here's some things you could figure out. Here's some things you could fix. It's pretty good, like just to see how.
But it can do it on your mobile stuff too, which is cool.
Yeah. It just they have like this little page analyzer, and it's pretty helpful, pretty accurate too. I would recommend it. So yeah.
Well, there you go. Hey, Shopomaniacs, there is a job opening that we think you should know about. It's over at Close. That's close.io. Head over there and look at the app. One look at it and you can tell this is a JavaScript app, and that is exactly what they are hiring. They are hiring a JavaScript front engineer and UI engineer. Close, it's a sales app. So close meaning like close a sale, you know? It's all about unifying these sales calls and sales emails. Really nice looking app. And they need you, experienced JavaScript and front-end people, to work there. Don't want to move? Good, because it's a remote job. Work from anywhere in the world. It's an open source shop. They're using tons of open source software and contributing back to those open source projects, which is great. Just a perfect job for all you Shop Talk Show listeners out there. Come on over and click the link in the show notes to get the link to this the job opening, where you can learn all about, you know, what their expectations are and what you can expect from them. This is a full-time job at close.io. All right, let's see. Nick Novak, is that where we're on here? First off, love the show. Thanks, Nick. Currently, I'm working on a site using Jekyll. I ran into something I've never dealt with before, and I'm finding out about user agent style sheets. I'm trying to target my links in my CSS, but they're being overridden by this user agent style sheet. Any advice and info would be much appreciated. Nick, you're not the first person. I've heard this from somebody else who asked me a CSS question the other day, and I'm like, I don't know. I tried to do some styling, but then I looked, and it looked like the browser was overriding what I was doing with its user agent style sheet. Now, if you've never heard of that, it's an easy thing to see. You just go to some website, inspect the element, and usually the dev tools are at least in Edge and Chrome and Firefox and Safari, I'm pretty sure, all in there. DevTools will have like a way that you can see your CSS being applied and which CSS file came from. But like I'm looking in Chrome right now in the DevTools, and there's like a darker gray block that is the block of the user agent style sheet. So instead of it saying global CSS, that's where this rule lives, it literally says user agent style sheet. You know what those are, Dave?
Yeah, like so there used a lot of plugins used to offer Monkey Wrench or what Grease Monkey used to offer user agent style sheets.
I think you can alter them if you want to. I'm not sure if that's so much the case anymore. Or like you can add an additional style sheet if you want to. But I think the ones that are talked about here are like literally the browser just has some default styles for stuff. So if you apply no CSS at all to a site, it like a paragraph element will still have some margin on it. Header elements will still be sized larger than other ones. You know what I mean? It's like the CSS that's just like inherent to a web page.
Yeah. And then Yeah. Let's see. I don't know what to say.
I think what's confusing to me is that, like, the way that these user agent style sheets are written, and you can find copies of them, like, just Google around and it will show you how to find the actual style sheet. It really is CSS that's applied to every single page. It's written in such a way that the selectors are the minimum possible specificity for that selector. So if you write anything at all in your own CSS, it will override what's in the user agent style sheet. So I would be interested to see what you think the user agent style sheet is overriding you, or in what case. Because I think it might just be a case of confusion or misinterpreting the dev tools, or, you know, it could be a bug. So it's not, I'm not automatically saying you're wrong, but, like, it would be interesting to see, you know.
Sometimes browsers will make weird choices by default. Then I saw this tweet from Umar Hansa, Umar with two A's. Paul Irish retweeted him, but he dug up a link to Chrome's HTML.css. So it's got kind of all their default little user agent stuff. Here, yeah, I can post it in the old, whatchamacallit. What do we call it? We call it our show notes. That's what we call it.
That, and you know, you'll notice if you find a good, like, source that links to a bunch of these, that they're different across browsers a little bit. Like, it's not so bad these days, but it is a little bit different, and that's why CSS resets exist. This is why. This is the number one reason.
But there's some, like, crazy stuff, like input type equals search I, which is case insensitive. Apparently you can do :: WebKit search cancel button.
Oh,
WebKit,
yeah.
Appearance search field cancel button. WebKit user modify read only important. You know, this is,
you're going to learn some weird stuff looking at these style sheets for sure. There's very proprietary stuff in here, which is not necessarily a bad thing. It's just like, I don't. Maybe it is a bad thing, but you know, I don't have this as a fully formed thought. But it's just kind of like, don't even worry about this. It's just a selector to do something specific that we need to do in here. It might even be normalizing things better or something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and what's funny is, I mean, this could, I don't know, like, you'd probably learn a lot about browsers and a lot about hacks that they do and.
Yeah, they use the matches selector quite a bit in these style sheets, I notice, for whatever reason, which is, like, not, you don't see that very oftenly used, even though it's got more and more support lately. I don't know if you ever use that, but it's pretty weird.
Yeah, well, and all
they,
right,
they use variables a bunch. Yeah, anyway, I should do a blog post, like 10 things I learned through looking through a browser user agent style sheet.
Yeah, I was maybe way off about that Grease Monkey stuff, but I just thinking, like, people used to inject their own was sort of what, like.
Yeah, well, some browsers used to support that. Like, do you want to add additional styles to the page? And people would do it sometimes. And in fact, it used to be like a subject in old blog posts about CSS. People would, there would always be the, like, but well, actually, guy or whatever, like, you know, oh, I didn't set a background color on the body element. Well, you should, because if you don't, I set a user agent style sheet that is monkeys scratching their butt GIF. And so on your website, I don't see white. I see monkeys scratching their butt. So joke's on you, kind of thing. Like,
you failed. Oh, internet, keep it up. Old Bertram writes in, I like using SVG icon systems based on Xlink and use. You often write about it on CSS Tricks. It works great. I can label icons accessibly using aria label, and hover styles work perfectly. I have one problem though. Back when I used icon fonts, I could easily use icons in CSS with something like before element simply by setting the font family to the icon font and using Unicode, etc. Is there a way to use SVG icons like this? Can you SVG into?
I think Ole is just basically saying, I liked icon fonts. They were easier to implement for me or whatever. Like, as an author, I would just, like, oh, I need to add an icon. I'll just use a pseudo element and set a character there and make the font family that or whatever. The danger there is that was never a very good way to implement icon fonts. like you could use pseudo element, but really you should use a span and put the pseudo element on the span. That way you could use aria attributes on the span because you needed some aria attributes to do things correctly and stuff. So it was never that easy anyway. But by the time you had a span and then you had a class on the span to target it in CSS to apply the icon that you needed, and you had all the aria attributes on the span, it's not that much different than an SVG element with the proper aria labels and the xlink and all that stuff. So I never found them that different to implement the correct way anyway. So there's that. There's even more to this, really. I mean, all the other advantages you get out of SVG land. The fact that if you what you really don't like is typing out SVG and then maybe a view box and then the use and the xlink href and then closing the SVG and all that stuff. I've seen people have like, you know, people that work in React, they make a React component, so you just end up using icon. So that's just, like, nice. It saves you. I've seen people use nunchucks macros for their, like, if you're processing node style, you know, they'll use a thing. I know. Have you ever used nunchucks?
No, but is that just, like...
Getting really popular these days.
Really?
Yeah, it's like a templating thing.
Like just... whatever text expander stuff, or is it?
No, it's more like Jade and Haml or whatever.
Oh, okay.
It's a full featured. It's like that, but for like Node, you know.
Oh, interesting. I will have to
by Mozilla, which is why I think people, whatever, use it and stuff. But it has so you write like you write curly bracket number sign. That's like the nunchucks. Version of a thing, and then and you can do includes, and you can, I don't know, you can do loops, and you can pass data around, which is the macros thing, you know. So you can be like curly bracket number sign icon, and then send it some information about that icon, and then close that out, and that'll just call that macro. That way, if you ever want to change what's in that chunk, it's just a partial. It's a
templating language. Yeah. I'm looking at now. That looks pretty good. Looks okay. All right. Okay. Go. I was going to, can you do background image with an ID to the thing?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of how, what's the super popular SVG icon thing by Filament Group?
Oh, Grunticon.
Yeah. That's, they work all through pseudo elements and stuff and background images. But, oh, I mean, could you pass a fragment identifier in a background? Yes, you can also do that. That's less supported, though. I wouldn't count on it, but that's coming.
Okay. Because I'm like CSS's job is to paint the HTML, right? And it's less like HTML and SVG's job to paint or inform the CSS, right? So I'm trying to, like, work with, who controls what. So I think you're in a tough position if you want to use HTML in your CSS. I think that's just tough. So anyway, all right, cool. Hopefully that we
didn't you use it because you were like, oh, it makes service workers easier because then I don't have to screw around with telling about every single icon in cache.
Yeah, actually, I'm switching. I'm a big fan of external SVGs, just because I like the cacheability. I like just the it's basically just an image tag, or even you can use it in an image tag sort of thing. It's like a sprite sheet thing. But I no, you can't use it in an image tag, but SVG use, yes. Anyway, okay, starting over. I'm a big fan of external SVGs, but because of service workers, I'm now maybe moving all to internal, like embedded SVGs, like where I'll just require the file in my HTML. Just because, yeah, service worker, you have to, I'm getting into that. And if you want to cache things, you have to like explicitly write out whatever file you're caching. And I'm like, well, I don't want to like cache all my icon, like every icon file or whatever for this thing. So I'm just going to like start putting them straight in the source of the HTML. And that's going to work for me. But I'll probably do the like defs block thing and then still use SVG use, but I won't make a async request or a request for it. So hopefully that made sense. Chris, I think we're out of questions.
I think we are too.
Hey, okay, thank you for listening to another episode of Shop Talk Show. Be sure to star heart favorite this up in your favorite podcatcher of choice. That's how people find out about the show. You can also tweet at the show at Shop Talk Show. Follow us for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs. Get a brand new one because people want to hire you. And Chris, do you have anything else?
Shoptalkshow.com.